Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Governor Peter Shumlin's decision not to seek a fourth term has set off a mad scramble by a number of candidates who are interested in this office. So far, three Democrats have announced their candidacies. House Speaker Shap Smith, former Transportation Secretary Sue Minter, and former Windsor Senator Matt Dunn. Two Republicans say they're running, businessman Bruce Lisman and Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. After serving three terms as lieutenant governor, Scott says his top priority would be taking steps to improve the Vermont economy. What specific proposals does he have in mind? And where does he stand on many other key issues? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. It's great to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me on.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What do you think are the major issues in Vermont's 2016 gubernatorial race? What issues do you really want to see the candidates address? Let us know. Do you think there's some specific steps that should be taken to strengthen the Vermont economy? And should lawmakers consider raising new revenue instead of making further reductions to next year's state budget if that's necessary? Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. I want to mention right at the start that we have invited all five of the announced gubernatorial candidates to discuss their campaigns on Vermont Edition. To date, Shap Smith, Matt Dunn, and now Phil Scott have taken us up on the offer. Bruce Lisman and Sue Minter say they'll join us in the not-too-distant future. So, Lieutenant Governor Scott, by many measurements, the Vermont economy is in pretty good shape. We just heard the Vermont unemployment rate, one of the lowest in the country, still very low. A new report says thousands of jobs are being added to the state's renewable energy sector. And yet you say, quote, families and employers are on the economic edge and that the state is in trouble financially and that Vermont has a crisis of affordability. Aren't the labor numbers and the growth of the energy sector evidence that the economy is actually doing pretty well?
Well, I think if you get out into throughout Vermont, you'll find a different story. Certainly, the Chittenden County area is doing better than most other areas of the state. But again, as I travel around, you begin to get a complete understanding that folks are struggling. And it's about the costs of living, the crisis of affordability that I've been talking about for quite some time. They're struggling, you know, working two and three jobs sometimes, trying to make ends meet. They're not fulfilling that. They're trying to pay their property taxes, which have skyrocketed. And they've been screaming for relief in that area as well. And so what we have is a dynamic where we have a demographic shift in Vermont. We have an aging population. We have stagnant 625,000 people, but we're losing our workforce. We've lost people out of our workforce over the last number of years. We've lost a number of people, 30,000 people out of that category from 25 to 45, according to the last census between 2000 and 2010. So what that does is it sets us an incredible dynamic because those are the folks that pay taxes. That's the working class. They're the ones that have families. They buy homes. And so when you have that dynamic, you have less kids that you're educating. There are less kids in our schools to the tune of about 20,000 less kids now than 20 years ago. So that's about 1,000 kids a year. But we're maintaining that overhead. It's about the same overhead, less students, less revenue. So that puts more burden, more pressure on property taxes, which, again, increases the cost of living for people that are struggling to get by in Vermont.
I want to talk to you about property taxes in just a moment. But in terms of revitalizing the state economy, what are two or three specific things that you would propose to deal with this situation?
I should go back just and answer your question as well about the unemployment rate. That doesn't tell the whole story. We have to look at net numbers, and our unemployment rate is low. That's great news for us, But when you have a shrinking workforce, that happens naturally. And so, again, we may even have jobs available that are here, opportunities, but we need to have them a higher paying opportunity. And as well, the cost of living has to be appropriate so that our kids can afford to live here. They get out of school and they have a huge student debt, and they can't find jobs to fulfill their needs. So they look elsewhere. I'm very mobile in these times.
So is that an argument on your part that you think we ought to have a living wage?
No, I'm saying that we need more competition. When you have more competition, and when there are opportunities out there, and there are more jobs, and we have a fast-paced economy, you will see wages increase naturally. It happens in our business. I've been in business for 30 years, and you can see those times when you have there's more demand than you have people. The cost of jobs increases. As well as the costs associated with providing better wages for your employees. So it happens naturally with a thriving economy.
So tell me two or three things that you would make top priorities if you're elected governor and you go before the legislature to talk about your priorities in your first inaugural address. What are two or three things that you're going to recommend that you think would have a pretty big impact on strengthening the Vermont economy?
Well, first of all, we have to get our own house in order from a budgetary standpoint. We can't spend more than we're taking in, which is what we've been doing over the last few years. We're spending at about a 5% growth rate versus a revenue rate of about 3%. It's a recipe for disaster. So we have to give some certainty to Vermonters, to our constituents, to our businesses, that we know how to keep our house again in order, so that we can all prosper more. There's specific proposals that will be forthcoming in a broader economic package. But as you know, I've been going around the state for the last year or so with the Vermont economy pitches. And we've been hearing a number of provisions that would be helpful to businesses. What I wanted to highlight during those economy pitches was, we want to hear what we can do proactively to help you. What is it that we need to do as legislators, as lawmakers, to help our business climate in Vermont? And something, there's a number of provisions that came forth that I think have merit, and a lot of them we incorporated into the legislation that was passed last session, which was great news. You know, angel tax investment and a number of other initiatives. But certainty is one that many businesses are asking for relief. They want to know what their future, what lies in their future. We had a, when we talk about single payer, that was brought forth 3 or 4 years ago as a proposal. Governor Shumlin, I think, ran on that issue initially. And it was a worthwhile discussion, I thought, at least to be objective about whether this was something that could be worthwhile for Vermonters in Vermont, and whether it fit us and how it really worked. Could we actually afford it? What does it mean for us? And when it finished, the governor came to the conclusion that we couldn't afford it, and pulled that provision off the table. But that discussion went on for 5 or 6 years and created an enormous amount of uncertainty throughout the economic picture. Because when I talk to businesses about coming into our state, about landing here or expanding here, they were reluctant because they didn't know what we were going to do with our health care. And they didn't know what that was going to mean to us. Is that going to be a 15, a 16, or an 18% income tax for us, or a payroll tax? They didn't know, and nobody was providing details. So when you don't have details, you provide uncertainty. And I think that may have been one factor that complicated our economic growth.
Today on the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He is seeking the Republican gubernatorial nomination. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You talked about the state budget growing by about 5%, state revenues growing by about 3%. The reason that's possible is some one-time money, I believe, was used to fill in the gap. So if the budget should only grow by as much as revenue growth, which right now is 2 or 3%, where are you going to recommend cuts in the state budget? As you look at cutting back some departments, what areas would you cut?
Well, again, first, let's go back a little bit again to the proposal of actually growing the economy and bringing in revenue more naturally, organically, rather than changing our tax structure. If we could focus on the economy, if we could get all on the same page, which I had proposed over the last 2 to 4 years, that would have a dramatic effect on our economy, again, by bringing revenue more naturally rather than forcing the issue. Because, as I've said, I think we're at the end of our ropes in terms of trying to initiate any new tax proposals. I think Vermonters have had enough. And as well, there's not a willingness in the legislature to cut. So when you have that dynamic, you have to look for that third approach. There are a number of ways that we can, I think, get into the 21st century in terms of providing systems that would be more efficient, that would fit Vermont in unique and different ways. And those should be considered in our future. You have to go to the big areas in terms of where would you, if you have to cut, where are they? And human services is an area that certainly is one of our largest cost drivers. So when we look at that, it's always been a challenge. And I'm not saying this is going to be easy. It doesn't matter who the next governor is. They're going to be faced with challenges here that are going to be very difficult and difficult for Vermonters. But there's going to be some short-term pain here regardless. But the long-term ramifications, if we do this right, could be dramatic and could be prosperous for Vermont, but we have to put in place initiatives that will actually increase revenue and bring in more prosperity. But again, human services is an area that we've always been challenged to try and thread that needle of trying to take care of those who can't take care of themselves, and we have a responsibility to do that as a government. But at the same time, we don't want to provide a lifestyle that people rely on that are able to work and to take some self-responsibility. So, again, it's going to be trying to negotiate our way through that, trying to thread that needle to find areas that we can actually help people, give them a hand up rather than a handout.
Let's talk about solar siting for just a moment. There's a very healthy debate going on whether or not towns should have the ability to reject a proposed solar project. You know, it comes at a time now when there are dozens of projects. Everybody's trying to get it in before the deadline at the end of 2016 when a huge federal tax credit expires. We've got a case in front of the Vermont Supreme Court involving Rutland Town. What are your thoughts? Do you think towns, individual towns, should have the ability, the authority to say, you know what, we don't want this project in our community? Should towns have that authority?
I believe they should. I think that there needs to be more input from towns in regards to siting, trying to create some screening. It's not to say that the project shouldn't move forward, but they should have some input as well. We need to, and a lot of the development, as you said, is in regards to tax credits. That's what's driving so much of this siting of solar. And I think solar is in the future. I think that that's where it's at. As you know, I've been somewhat critical of some of the ridgeline development with wind generation. I think that's outdated from my standpoint. But I think solar has, no pun intended, a bright future. And what we need to do is to have a better, healthier dialogue between communities. We also need to figure out where we actually need the solar. Where do we need to produce power? Where are the needs throughout the state? And rather than trying to cite them because of available space to try and designate where we can do that and do that efficiently with the transmission infrastructure in place, because that's the other unknown. When you site some of these renewable sources, energy sources, you have to distribute the power after that. So what does that mean, and where, how do we get it to the next to the location that needs it?
I think folks in Rutland Town would say that that they need to have some clear-cut authority over the siting and the regulating of solar projects in their community. And when they hear people say, well, yeah, they should have more say in the matter, the bottom line then still is, hey, it's up to the Public Service Board. The Public Service Board says, well, we recognize your concerns, but project is going through anyway.
Yeah. No, again, I think when we can determine where the need is, if there's a specific need in an area for power, then the project will probably need to move. But again, we're going blindly throughout Vermont, just citing where there's space available, regardless of what the need is. So I think that's first. But again, I do believe that more local control is needed. I think they should be able to say we don't want this project in our area. I think that's appropriate.
Today on the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, who is seeking the Republican gubernatorial nomination. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Brandon, who is calling from Marlboro. Hi, Brandon. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Mr. Scott, I'm calling. I'm glad you mentioned your business earlier, because one of the most concerning aspects about your candidacy for me is the fact that your business has received $3.8 million in state contracts since the beginning of your time in public office. I know you've mentioned that you want to set up a blind trust between yourself as governor and your business, but I'm just concerned that that's not enough. And what do you think about that? Do you really think that Vermonters can go forward with this blind trust?
Well, I certainly hope so, and I appreciate the call. I'm very proud of the business that I've been a part of, family business for the past 30 years. We've been in business since 1946. Integrity and trust is something that I believe in. I believe in transparency. I think anyone that knows me and the business that that I'm a part of knows that I try to do things right and upfront and fully transparent. The work that we do with the Agency of Transportation and others is it's a fully transparent process. It's a bidding process. It's one where you can go online, you can see the results of the bid. I would contend that while $3.6 million is an incredible amount of money, that's over quite a period of time. And that really, when you break down a bid, it's very little that comes back to the contractor. I've said from the very beginning, and this is something that I'm the one that started talking about this initially, because when people asked me if I was interested in running for governor, I said that one of the areas, the obstacles that I had to consider was how I was going to deal with our business, because our business does do business with the state of Vermont, we in a contractual relationship. And I said that not because the Constitution, not because any rule precludes me from doing so, but I thought it was best for Vermonters to restore that faith and trust in our elected officials by putting our business in a blind trust, disassociating myself completely with the business so that I had no connection, no interaction with the business whatsoever. So I've been working at that for the last few months. trying to put a plan in place. I've got all the pieces together. I think it can work, and I think that, again, that I can give comfort to Vermonters that that there will not be any involvement from me. Because being governor, to be quite honest with you, is a full-time job, more than a full-time job. And I think you have to direct your attention to that, and I fully am fully prepared to do so.
So let's look at this idea of a blind trust. And some of the critics of your plan are saying, you know, when a political leader owns a stock portfolio, let's say, and they put the money in a blind trust, then they have no idea where the money is ever being invested. And so it works in that regard. Now, in your case, what you're saying, I'll put it in a blind trust. I won't know what the company is doing. But the Agency of Transportation, which is reviewing these contracts, is fully aware that this company is co-owned by the governor if you're elected governor. So does the blind trust analogy really work here?
Well, again, go back to when you do those contracts. This is a bid process. You have a number. If it's all fully transparent, there's a notice of a bid of a job. You put in your request to bid the job. You receive the bid documents and you fill them out. Then you turn the number of companies competing. Then you turn in your bid, and then the Agency of Transportation opens those bids publicly and shows the results. So there is no opportunity for any favoritism at that point because they are taking the low bid. Because you're pre-qualified, you have to have a bid bond, you have to have performance bonds, you have to have all kinds of things to do so. They
but the agency doesn't always take the lowest bid. There can be other circumstances.
The only time I've seen in my history of doing any business with the Agency of Transportation where they didn't take the low bid was when somebody made a mistake on the bid document. That's the only – I've never seen them take a second or third bidder by assuming that they weren't responsible enough or they didn't want them to bid or to do the project. I've never seen that.
So why not just say this company is not going to bid on state projects? If you're elected governor and you begin serving in January of 2017, the company just isn't going to take these projects. From what I understand, it represents about 10% of the business. So you could be done with it that way.
Well, 10% of a business is like being viable and not being viable. I don't want to tie the hands of the business. As I've said, I've worked very hard at this business, very proud of that, for the last 30 years. I want it to thrive. We have a number of employees that have been there decades. We had one employee that's semi-retired now that has been there for over 50 years, never had another job. So why do I want to restrict some of my employees that I care deeply about so that they can't be viable in their future? 10%. We're all living on the edge here from a business perspective. Anyone that's been in business knows how extremely, extremely difficult it is to continue to do business in Vermont. And we are on the edge all the time. You have to use everything at your disposal. You have to in our business. People ask what do you specialize in, and I say we'll dig your mailbox hole or we'll do your sewer system. You know, we'll do everything in between because you have to be versatile in order to be successful. And to be successful, meaning in Vermont, is surviving.
Today in the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, who is seeking the Republican gubernatorial nomination in 2016. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Just to close out thinking on this, have you considered the possibility that if you are elected governor in November of 2016, that by January of 2017, you would just sell your interest in the company?
Well, that could be a consideration, but for me, I've been involved in this business for 30 years. I like the business, to tell you the truth. I don't intend to be a career politician. I'd like something to go back to. I don't have any stocks and bonds and other things. This is my life, and it's the life of many others as well. and I have a responsibility for my family and others. And again, I don't want to be in politics forever. I'd like something to go back to actually work at in a different capacity and see some things through that that I've had some vision for a number of years. So at this point in time, I don't have any interest in getting out of business, but you never know what happens. You know, that could be something that that just makes more sense in the future.
So is the bottom line is you're going to present this blind trust idea to voters and let them decide if it works for them?
I think I can explain to them. And again, faith and trust is something that I think has been lost throughout our nation, in Vermont in general, in our elected officials. And I think it's absolutely imperative that voters have that trust in me. So it's incumbent upon me to show them that I have that ability and that this makes sense. And I think I can convince voters that that it's appropriate.
You know, some people who are supporting an ethics commission say, yes, faith and trust has been great in Vermont, but, you know, the time is coming where we need to have more guidelines in place. And they actually think your situation is a perfect example of why the state needs an ethics commission, because they say if one was in place right now, you could go to the commission and say, here's how I'm suggesting this be dealt with. What do you think? Does this work?
Well, you know, I've been in favor of an ethics commission. I think it's it does make some sense. I think the devil is going to be in the details. I'm not interested in creating another layer of bureaucracy that costs millions of dollars to have in place. I think that we can come up with something that makes some sense so that you can, as you said, go to this commission, present your case, and they can take a look at it. But again, who is going to sit on that panel? How are you going to be able to have faith and trust in those that sit on the panel? So it's kind of a unique process. But the other thing about being in Vermont is, and we all face this, we're such a small state. We know each other. We have people that we know. I mean, I think you can, you don't have to go very far to find people that have perceived possible conflicts because of their spouse or their family members. I mean, there's just so many people and so many things that we do we're involved in, and we're so versatile. So, again, I think transparency is the answer, and I'm fully prepared to be transparent. And I have been, because as you remember, I'm the one that brought it up to begin with. So I'm the one that's being transparent. And I would like to have an opportunity to provide that, that faith and trust in voters.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Lee in Fayston. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking the time, Lieutenant Governor, for being on the air, and I want to commend you for getting out into the community with your everyday tour, Wheels for Warmth, and being a people's person. And I'd just like to ask you, what have you learned most from speaking to the people, and what are some of your plans?
Well, again, thank you for the call. You know, my Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour is something that I started when I first came into office, and I have learned an incredible amount because I've gotten to had the opportunity to work side by side with both employers and employees, and some of the common theme that I hear back is common to both, which is that they're struggling struggling to make ends meet. Property taxes is such a huge burden to both the employees and the employers. And they have choices, and that's, I think that's what we have to consider. We have a great quality of life here. We have a great story to tell, and we have a lot of opportunity. But at the same time, we know that our citizens are able to move not too far away to get some relief and still enjoy Vermont in different ways. So it's incumbent upon us to focus on the economy, trying to listen to Vermonters, to not spend more than we're taking in. I think that's Vermonters are asking that we are as prudent with our pocketbooks, their pocketbooks, as they are in their own personal lives. and try and create some certainty. Be better partners with businesses throughout Vermont. Listen to them and what their needs are, so that we can have some confidence again. Some of the economy, as we know, on a national level, is based on confidence. So we see an uptick in the economy when we as consumers are more confident in our futures. We don't like uncertainty. And I think that we feel the same way in Vermont, our businesses do. If we have more certainty, if we understand that we have a partner, we have somebody that will listen to us, and trying to help us, help businesses succeed, that we all prosper in the end. So I think that I will listen. I've certainly learned an awful lot, and I'm prepared to lead.
Let's talk to Ralph, calling from Enosburg Falls. Hi, Ralph. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes. Well, I want to just getting back to the kind of conundrum of why we have such a low unemployment rate and yet people are struggling so much. This is from something that was in the County Courier August 27th by William J. Mathis, who's the managing director of the National Education Policy Center and a member of the Vermont State Board of Education. I'll be brief here, though. He just says, businesses often complain about the inability to hire qualified people. The right question may be, why are our talented young people leaving the state? When the top job openings in the state are, in order, personal care aides, cashiers, retail salespeople, food workers and waiters, preparing a 21st century workforce is a call to generate a highly credentialed group of underemployed young adults, often staggering under unmanageable student loans. The Vermont Department of Labor's June 2015 long-term projections show only 18% of jobs in 2022 will require a bachelor's degree or higher. So we got this, yeah, everybody's working, but their jobs don't pay enough to make ends meet. Okay, that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay, Ralph, thanks very much. Would you consider a plan to say to young people who are going to college in Vermont, if you stay in Vermont afterwards, after you graduate, there might be some sort of tuition subsidy?
I let me add this. I would like to study whether we could give an income tax break, maybe eliminate income taxes for a certain period of time. If you stay in Vermont, take a job in Vermont, and so forth. Maybe a certain age group doesn't get hit with any income tax. I think that we can't afford everything, obviously, but we have to come up with more incentives for our young folks to live or come here. You know, we talk a lot about not wanting our kids to leave, which selfishly, I have two daughters and one is in living in Providence as we speak. So I would like my kids to be here, but at the same time, we need to encourage others to come. And if it's not our own kids staying, maybe it's new folks coming in. And, you know, and I know that this this proposal is something that may be a little bit topical, I guess, and maybe controversial. But I think we need to look in Vermont at more legal immigration. We see what's happening in Burlington. I grew up in Barrie, and when you growing up in Barrie, we have an incredibly rich ethnic history, and it's all revolving around granite. And it's we have the French and the Italians and the Scots that all came to Barrie to craft the rock. So we could do the same thing. Again, diversity would be great for Vermont. We have an instantaneous need for a workforce, maybe a better workforce in some respects. And I think that we should be welcoming and encouraging some legal immigration into Vermont to fill those schools. You have more families, bring more kids back in so that we could continue to have this overhead that we are being burdened with, but have some revenue to bring about as well and to utilize.
And on this income tax plan for young people where perhaps young workers wouldn't be paying the state income tax, are you thinking, you know, maybe it's anybody between the age of 22 and 30 in the state of Vermont?
Yeah, I'm thinking of some sort of an age category. It's going to be, you know, we took a look at some numbers a few years ago, and it's not dramatic, but certainly we'd have to be careful in how it's crafted. But again, when I look, when I hear some of the proposals in New York on some of the airwaves about tax-free for 10 years, and whether that's working or not, I don't know, but it sure sounds good. And I think that we need to compete in a different way. And if we have a need for more, an enlarged workforce, if we have a need for more of our youth to stay and come to Vermont, we need to provide incentives for them to do so. And this could be a way, a small price to pay, an investment to pay for our longevity. I think we could be more prosperous with a more enlarged workforce.
Let's see if we can get a quick call in from Colby, who is calling from Vershire. Hey, Colby, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to ask Mr. Scott about what's he going to do with education and property tax, and now that the states, you know, they've been doing this new rule of how they want to consolidate school districts, and how the state, you know, plans to use that money, and then how they plan to, you know, cut our property taxes and you know, stabilize education, I guess.
Okay, Colby, thanks very much. We've only got a little bit of time. Act 46 passed last session. Does it go far enough?
Yeah. Again, anything we could do was hopeful, but we didn't do enough. I think Vermonters were screaming for relief, as I've said, for a number of years. We weren't listening. We as the legislature wasn't listening and did nothing for instantaneous tax relief.
So what could be done that would provide instantaneous property tax relief?
Well, we're seeing some of the results. We're going to see some results from this consolidation plan. Maybe that should have been implemented long before now. I think there are a number of other measures that probably could have taken place. I think that we need to actually work with Congress, our congressional delegation. I think that the federal government has been shortchanging us on special ed. They haven't been fulfilling their responsibility in some of the mandates that have been put in place. We should put a moratorium on any new mandates out of the legislature that would increase the cost of education immediately.
Do you think, and we've only got a little bit of time, has the time come to revisit Act 60 and Act 68?
Well, I think a natural evolution, it will. We're going to have to. Because it's not sustainable in its present form. Vermonters can't afford to pay the property taxes that they are being burdened with at this point.
It's going to be a fascinating gubernatorial primary campaign on both the Republican and Democratic side. Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Coming up next, I'll talk to Aaron Mansfield from VT Digger about the boom in solar projects across the state. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's a lot of interest in developing solar power projects across Vermont these days. Many small rooftop projects are being installed, and some gigantic projects that are the size of 100 football fields are also being proposed. So what's driving this rush to build solar projects? And should local communities have any say about the projects that are proposed for their towns? With us now to take a look at these issues is Aaron Mansfield, a reporter for VT Digger. Aaron, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Bob.
And I want to mention right off the top that Aaron has written an excellent two-part series on the development of solar power in Vermont and the controversy surrounding some of these projects. You can check it out online at vtdigger.org. So, Aaron, it seems like we're in the middle of an enormous growth spurt in solar energy projects in Vermont. Why is this happening? What's fueling this incredible growth?
So the biggest fuel for the solar industry across the nation is a tax credit. There's a federal tax credit that allows corporations and homeowners to write off about a third of the project cost. And one of the things that's fueling this, especially in 2014 and 2015, and again in in 2016, is the fact that this tax credit was set up by Congress, and it's set to expire at the end of 2016. Because things are so uncertain in Congress, no one's really betting on it.
So this is a huge tax credit, and if there's some uncertainty about it being renewed, people are saying it's now or never?
They're not saying it's now or never. They're saying, hey, let's get it done now instead of waiting.
Now, in addition to these federal tax credits, what is it about Vermont that's drawing some of these solar projects?
So there are a lot of things about Vermont. We have a lot of farmland that sits right next to three-phase transmission power on the Velco lines on Route 7. We also have a political will of a legislature, a governor, and others who really want to see renewable energy developed. The development of solar energy has been cited as a way for Vermont to reach its goal of 90% renewable by 2050. And that's another one of the things that's making this attractive to some folks.
So it seems like we've got really two things going on. We've got commercial developers with some pretty large projects, and we have a lot of homeowners who are also putting in solar installations.
That's correct.
And the advantage for the homeowners is what?
The advantage for the homeowner is that if you produce too much, your power company has to buy it back, and it has to buy it back at a higher rate because you made it with a renewable source. It's going to buy it through a process of credits on your bill. So let's say I had solar on my home. I'd have about 6 kilowatts on my home. I'm going to produce a whole lot more during the summer when the days are sunny and long than in the winter. So what I'm going to do is my power company is going to give me credits, and I'm going to build those up for the winter, and I'm pretty much going to not pay energy bills all year because I have solar.
Now, with this huge demand going on of all these projects, not everybody is thrilled about the expansion of solar projects. Some communities are trying to take steps to restrict the siting of projects in their towns. There's a big fight going on right now in Rutland Town. Tell us about that fight.
So what's going on is Rutland Town makes a donut around Green Mountain Power's Solar City, which is interesting. What's going on there is that there's a 2.2 megawatt project being proposed. If you've ever seen a project, 2.2 megawatts is probably the biggest one you've seen in Vermont. The biggest ones are about that big. And what's going on is that the town doesn't want it. The town even enacted siting standards to try to keep it from happening. They went to the Public Service Board and tried to stop it from happening. The Public Service Board approved it anyway, and they decided to take it to the Supreme Court.
So the reason that it has to go to the Public Service Board is that local communities right now don't have the authority to say, hey, we don't want this project in our town?
Right. I mean, it's a utility regulatory process. It's all going to be done at the state level. It's distinct from Act 250, and that's one of the things that's driving these concerns. The Section 248 process mimics a legal process with lawyers and experts and everyone wearing suits. Act 250 is a little different. And right now, towns can intervene in a public service board proceeding, but many of them just don't feel they're being heard. It's not that they can't intervene.
So the Vermont Supreme Court is looking at this issue. Is the basic issue before the court what authority a local town has in the siting of solar projects?
That's certainly what at least one select board member wants to happen. If it set precedent, that would be the effect of it. But what we're really talking about at the Supreme Court level is that one case. Should 2.2 megawatts of solar split across Cold River Road, which is relatively rural?
But it could set a precedent, couldn't it? I mean, this is a decision that a lot of people are looking at very closely.
Yes, that's correct.
And what about the legislature? How is this issue reverberating in the legislature? Are there some lawmakers who want to give towns more authority?
There are definitely lawmakers that want to give more towns more authority. They tend to be a little bit more on the right. You'll talk to folks like Joe Benning. You'll talk to John Rogers. You'll talk to Butch Shaw from Pittsford. You'll talk to residents of New Haven or the Planning Commission in New Haven. They want to be able to give towns more deference. There have been bills that have been introduced but not passed or had hearings on them that would mean that, you know, a solar farm can only be on a brownfield site, right? A site that needs to be redeveloped. Most of those so far haven't actually had any hearings. And so what's going to happen is that when the Solar Siting Task Force, which met today, comes back in January, all eyes are going to be on what they reported. And so that task force is under a lot of pressure.
Do you have any sense in what approach that task force is going to take?
It looks like they're going to come up with a limit. They might tweak some of the standards they have for setback and screening, but it's yet to be seen what those specifics are.
Now, there's certainly lawmakers who strongly oppose efforts to give towns more authority or even veto power over their projects. What's their argument?
Their argument tends to be that, you know, the climate is changing rapidly. I think we had the warmest year in history this past year, and it's scheduled to be even warmer next year. That their perspective is that you can't slow down this clean energy development because it's going to worsen climate change.
Well, this promises to be one of the big issues of the 2016 legislative session. Once again, if you want to read Aaron's series on solar power, go to vtdigger.org. Aaron Mansfield, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
That's it for today. Coming up on Monday, superheroes, comic books, and costumes are all part of this weekend's Comic-Con. It'll be the second time that Vermont has hosted this homegrown celebration of geek culture. We'll talk with organizers and fans. That's Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.